The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Miriam, good morning, and it's wonderful to have you back in
good
studio.
Morning,
how are you
Shasta.
Doing?
Great to see you in the place, as it were, again.
Absolutely. Great. Now, we'll go straight to our very first query. It was held over from last month. Catherine got in touch to say, please, can you ask your legal expert if she can advise me? I haven't been paid for an event that was booked, then it was cancelled 20 minutes beforehand. It was a workshop. I've sent 3 invoices and 2 follow-up emails, and I was assured that I would be paid. And Miriam, after I sent this to you, Catherine came back to say she actually was finally paid, but it certainly took a while.
And a great relief that she was. And I suppose sometimes an organisation could say, look, it was an outside frustrating event, it might have been a COVID situation or something else, and they might be able to actually get out of paying someone, especially if they don't have a cancellation clause in their contract. It's like a business-to-business contract. So I suppose it highlights Catherine's issue there, highlights how important it is for business people to put in cancellation clauses. I mean, we see it in the hotel industry all the time. If you cancel within 24 hours or 36 hours, that you have to pay the full fee. So that's something that people would be well advised to put into their contract. I was looking at it as well from the other point of view. What if you were a participant and the workshop had been cancelled and getting your money back? And I suppose usually you'd have a right to get your money back, because a lot of these are booked online. So there's rights in relation to online contracts that would apply to it. And also a good idea might be, if the organisation was refusing to give money back, maybe getting a charge back on one's credit card, if one used a credit card, is another avenue as well. You know, if one isn't getting money from the organisation, that it might be a way of getting one's money back. If one was a participant in the workshop and they were refusing to get the money back. But it's great Catherine got sorted at the end of the day. I was actually thinking, you know, this particular problem as well is trying to get maybe refunds or money back from an organisation. And often if one rings the organisation and gets in touch with somebody personally at the end of the phone, often that can have a result as well, because the person will follow it up and make sure that one is paid as well. So it struck me as another route that one could use in these situations, personal approach.
And I've seen sometimes happening, and maybe it's not always ideal, but sometimes people are at the end of their tether not getting paid, and they actually go on social media and call out the company.
Yeah, you know? And that's it, like, that they should have to do that is regrettable, you know. So, like, it's basically usually getting in touch with the organisation. Very often it's kind of maybe lost in translation, as it were, in the accounts department. So often it's following up with the personal phone call can very often net results, rather than going off in the huff and maybe issuing the proceedings, which would be very expensive, if you know what I mean. So that would be the cheap alternative, as it were.
Now, someone else has this question. Free legal aid and how it works. Are all solicitors involved in the system, this listener wants to know? Or is it just that some doctors some solicitors or lawyers are? Is it along the lines of doctors and the medical card system? Is it only a few solicitors who are working the Free Legal Aid Board that can provide free legal aid? Thanks in advance.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because I suppose it just highlights there's 2 different legal aid systems in the country. One for the criminal law, where if one was up on an assault charge or something that involved risk of jail and one couldn't afford legal representation, the state service kicks in, and you have a choice of solicitors under that in relation to criminal legal aid. But in relation to civil legal aid, which would be the other avenues, which would be around family law, maybe queries around employment, tenancies, maybe where somebody is being sued for debt or for some other reason, or maybe someone's rights are being infringed and they need to follow up, or maybe a personal injuries case the private solicitors won't take, then the civil legal aid system kicks in. And that's operated by very experienced solicitors in legal aid centres throughout the country. So they would be the solicitors that one would go to in relation to getting civil legal aid. Now, the other issue there from the listener, they said it's free legal aid. Now, the criminal legal aid system, they don't ask you for money, but with civil legal aid, you're expected to give a contribution. So there is a contribution involved, and it's €30 for advice and €150 for going to court, which would include the 30 euro. So it's very cheap, but there is a contribution. So we call it civil legal aid rather than free legal aid. But as I say, it's an excellent system and operates, you know, people can go along, they can get advice on wills, on enduring powers of attorney, on a myriad of different items. They can get advice through the legal aid board, the civil legal aid board. The one areas they don't cover would be defamation, or if one was suing around property rights, aside from family law. And the other area that they won't deal with is the employment appeals tribunals. And that's been highlighted by FLAC as something that's regrettable. And hopefully they'll extend to that long term. The other service that's out there is FLAC, which is literally the Free Legal Advice Centre, but it's mainly based in the cities and wouldn't they operate clinics to the Citizens Information Centre, and we used to have one here in our local Citizens Information Centre, and that's literally free legal advice, and that's very handy for people just to go along and get advice for free. It's interesting that Free Legal Advice Service highlighted that they'd tons of queries in their last annual report. They'd increased dramatically for family law and employment law, and a huge increase, and a third of their queries were around family law. So it just shows there's a need out there to get the advice, and that people obviously would have approached the Free Legal Advice Centres. It's free, it doesn't cost anything, and they can they operate a helpline as well, which is very handy for people.
Now, this comes up, and it's a very difficult situation in relation to maintenance. Someone says, my former partner pays maintenance erratically. Erratically is the emphasis here. For our two children, he might pay €100 a month and then nothing the next month. What can you do in those instances?
Yeah, and I mean, it's soul destroying then sometimes trying to get the money. So maintenance is a legal obligation. So somebody, especially if the primary care of the children, can apply against the other partner, whether they're male or female, to get maintenance paid for the children and for the children's needs. So if it's being paid erratically, the most efficient way of sorting that out is to go to court. And one can get into court fairly quickly within about 2 months. And the judge looks at the person's means, who's paying the maintenance erratically, and the other person's means, and decides what's a fair amount for them to pay every week. And then an order is made, and that has to be paid every week. It's quite strict. If it's not paid, there is a risk of jail or imprisonment if the person doesn't pay maintenance. So maintenance is a very strong right. Once it's made a court order, the problem is if it's not a court order, there's no enforcement and the person might continue to pay erratically. And also with maintenance, one can get an order from the court to maybe deduct it from the person's salary. And if they went abroad, people can be pursued anywhere in the EU and in America as well in relation to the maintenance money. Now, it does take a bit of time, maybe a year or two, but they will get their money eventually. And if somebody skedaddled abroad, as it were. So it's at the end of the day, it's a very important support for families and to relieve child poverty, basically. So that's really important. It's really important remedy that's available from the courts.
I'm wondering, Miriam, this is probably outside the remit of this slot, but with the delays in the court system at the moment, in particular in family law, I'm just wondering, are there situations where people are breaching their maintenance orders and are effectively getting away with it at the moment because the case hasn't come up?
Oh no, like, we're very lucky down here that cases can go into court within a month or two and be heard, and the enforcement. The problem is that I suppose the person comes to court, they might pay a little bit or certain lump sum off it, and then they might continue in arrears and it has to be brought back into court again. So that's where it's very wearing on the person and who's bringing that kind of application, and they have to have a lot of resilience for that. But they will get their money eventually, and it's just a matter of being persistent. I suppose one, Tracy, you're right in that one must warn people that sometimes if somebody doesn't want to pay and they've been forced to pay, it might take a bit of time to get that into effect. But persistence is the key, and it will work eventually. It might take a bit of time.
Queries come in, and I don't think you can really give an answer because it depends, but look, I'll put it to you. Listener wants to know, what's the average price a solicitor charges an executor for settling an estate, I should say?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's how long is a piece of string, because the basis on which solicitors charge is usually based on time. If it's a simple estate that might involve a house and one bank account, there isn't a huge amount of time involved, so the amount to be paid for extracting that grant would be lower than a huge estate with lots of different bank accounts and loads of different share portfolios and all that, and property as well. So that would, and then it depends on the number of beneficiaries as to how many people have to be paid out. And and it's the size of the estate, really. So there are huge variations in the sense of the type of estate. So the best thing is to go along to the solicitor and get quotes in relation to it. And like, the solicitors are legally obliged to give their fees in advance of taking on work and give a person an indication of how much it will cost. But there's usually kind of ballpark figures for various types of estates.
And the advice would be, don't be afraid to shop around.
Yeah. And it does take time. The grants of probate and the grants of administration do take time, and there are costs involved, there's no doubt about it, including the fees for the actual grant, but, and maybe valuations and all that as well. But at the end of the day, shopping around, one can get an indication of is the price being told to the person fair.
Now, a family member is currently employed with a company for 10 years. This person is reaching her 66th birthday, and her employer wants her to sign a yearly contract now. Is this legal? She's a very loyal, punctual member of staff and very efficient at her job. Her current contract, which was signed 10 years ago, doesn't have a finish date.
Yeah, that's a difficult one in the sense that I suppose it depends on the what are the policies and procedures in the workplace, and also the retirement age in the workplace. Is there a set retirement age? As long as the employer is fair and reasonable, then, and can justify that kind of yearly contract, they may be within their rights in the situation. But she could always negotiate with the employer and say she feels a bit hard done by in this, that it's not being renewed for a longer period. But there obviously would be reasons, as people get older, that the retirement age now and the civil service is going up to 70. Employers have to justify if they're trying to get rid of people at 65, 66. You know, there's especially in the private sector. Again, subject to negotiation. And if there's a union in her workplace, they'd help her out in relation to it as well.
And we might return to it because, as you said, Miriam, it's quite knotty. So what we'll do is we'll return to it next month.
There's a lot in the retirement age issue.
There is,
and it's changing at the moment.
It is changing. I'm just seeing here, back in February, Age Action Ireland, they welcomed a report of the Oireachtas Committee on Social Protection, which was responding to a report of the Pensions Commission. And the committee here, the Oireachtas Committee, recommended that the mandatory retirement clauses be abolished. And again, if we'll explore that for next month, because issues. Because the company if that is the case, the company may not be doing anything wrong necessarily.
Exactly, because they're not actually enforcing any retirement age. They're just saying, look, we need to just have the year-to-year contract. There may be health and safety as employees get older, like very young employees, there may be health and safety issues that they have to be concerned about. So as long as the employer can justify their actions, they may be within their rights. But it's a very interesting area and very topical. So we'll come to it next month again. Trust that that'd be great.
And Miriam, finally, and thank you for joining us this morning. And any queries we don't get to today, we will get to next month, the last Tuesday of the month in July. Couple cohabiting and have two children. They're wondering, should they make a will? They own their family home jointly. They have individual accounts with large savings in their own names.
Yeah, I mean, this for cohabiting couples is just to highlight that because their tax thresholds are so low, it's 16,250, and anything above that, they could be taxed at 33%. It's very important that they plan as a family. Now, there is a family home exemption if they're living in the home for 3 years and they leave it to each other, that they should get that capital acquisitions tax exemption, that they shouldn't be taxed if something happens one of them and it goes to the other. But the individual accounts they have in their own name, in individual names, if they were one of them was to die and leave it to the other or leave it to the children, it might have significant tax implications. And there may be a way of setting up a trust for the children that would kind of get around that tax. So it's just to look at it from, it's very important, particularly where people are cohabiting, that they plan things for the family if something happens, one or other of them. And also to provide a trust for children if anything happened, both of them, and, you know, testamentary guardians for the children. So it's just to emphasise that point, even more than married couples, that because of the tax situation, they really need to plan for the future.
Okay, well, Miriam, thank you so much for joining us with this month's Legal Lowdown. It will be up as a podcast later on, and you'll also be able to look back on this on Radio Kerry's Facebook page as well. Miriam, it's great to have you back in studio, and thank you for joining us this morning. And as I said, if you've any queries for Miriam that you'd like her to address for next month, email kerrytoday@radiokerry.ie, or why don't you write to us? We always love to get letters to Radio Kerry, Main Street, Tralee, and just highlight Legal Lowdown for the attention of Miriam.